The Court of Appeals is now in session.
Be seated, please. Good afternoon. This is our second argument this afternoon. I'm Michael Gibbons, joined by Judge Bonnie Bulla and Judge Deborah Westbrook. Welcome, Timothy Wiseman.
Yes.
And this is for the pro bono program.
Yes, sir.
Hey, well, thank you so much for volunteering to help in this situation. And Ms. Pintar, you've been working on this case for a while. All right, I'll officially call the case then. It's number 85829-COA, Saeed Kangarolu versus Ali Kazim and Tanya Kazim. It's the time set for the oral argument. Mr. Wiseman, would you like to reserve any of your 15 minutes for a rebuttal?
5 minutes.
Okay. All right, we will proceed with the argument then.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Your Honors, this matter centers on a dismissal by the district court of a tort claim brought by the plaintiff, Mr. Kangarolu. The dismissal was based on claim preclusion centered on an order by the Justice Court. The question before this court, I would submit, is whether an order from a Justice Court can have preclusive effect for further actions when that order, when the judge in the prior action suggested that the plaintiff should proceed in another forum, and also when the Justice Court lacked appropriate jurisdiction in the matter in any event. I would respectfully submit that either one of those grounds is adequate to reverse the prior order and remand for proceedings on the merits. Your Honor, the Restatement of Judgment Second, Section 26, specifically states that a judge may preserve a plaintiff's right to bring a future action. I would suggest that that is exactly what the Justice Court judge did by instructing Mr. Kangarolu to proceed in another form. Now, I have to acknowledge that to the best of my knowledge, no appellate court in Nevada has ever directly considered that question, so that section has never previously been adopted. However, the Nevada Supreme Court has repeatedly cited the restatement of judgments favorably, including in Boca Park, citing to a different subsection of Section 26. It is a positively minuscule step to adopt this subsection and affirmatively state that a judge may reserve a plaintiff's right to bring a subsequent action under the right circumstances. I suspect that my esteemed friend will suggest that in any event, Mr. Kangarolu's statements regarding the Justice Court judge's statements are hearsay and therefore should be excluded. However, a government official acting in their official capacity is generally not subject to hearsay, or excuse me, I should say a statement by a government official acting in their official capacity is generally not subject to hearsay. Moreover, under authorities such as NRAP 9, parties are permitted to present statements of evidence of prior proceedings when a transcript or other more official recording is not available. Now, admittedly, Mr. Kangarolu did not precisely follow the steps in NRAP 9, and it's questionable whether that would directly apply. However, the policy behind that clearly supports precisely what he did. In the alternative, I would submit that the matter can be decided on the facts that the Justice Court, if it had rendered a full decision, would have been acting outside its jurisdiction. The Justice Court is a...
Can we tell what the Justice Court actually did from looking at that judgment? I mean, it looks like it's a form that's filled out and there's a dollar amount and you can tie that dollar amount into rent. Does that mean that nothing else was considered?
Your Honor, it is difficult to tell precisely what happened in front of the Justice Court, and that is, in fact, part of the problem. The judgment itself was a form that was filled out with little more than a dollar amount in a checkbox. The minutes from the court are not exhaustive, to put it mildly, and if a transcript could have been obtained, it was not and was not presented to the district court and therefore cannot be part of the record in front of this court. However, I would submit that Mr. Kangarolu's statements are adequate, especially when they're unrebutted, uncontested as to their accuracy.
Should we be reviewing this case as a dismissal under 12b-5, or should we look at it as a summary judgment matter? Because it appears that the district court did review documents outside the pleadings in reaching its decision.
Your Honor, I would submit that this should be addressed as a dismissal under 12b-5. It was phrased as a dismissal in the order itself. It was a request for dismissal, and while the judge did consider matters that were technically outside the pleadings, all of those matters were either court records from the justice court or what was in effect a statement of evidence about what happened at the justice court. There was no factual evidence regarding the underlying matters that were considered. However, I would also very respectfully submit that in this particular case, it almost doesn't matter. While the test for either one of them is reviewed under a de novo review, and while the test applied by the district court would be slightly different, in either case, I would submit that the order must be reversed. Even if not under a de novo standard of review, I would respectfully submit that there is plain error, which could be relevant if this court were to determine that certain of the plaintiff's arguments that I present now were not preserved for review, which I expect my esteemed friend is going to argue precisely that regarding the matter of the justice court's jurisdiction.
Well, however, let's talk about the justice court's jurisdiction for a moment, because when Mr. Kangaroo brought his complaint in justice court, didn't he, by availing himself of the justice court proceedings, accept the jurisdictional limit of the court? Otherwise, how do we distinguish the G.C. Wallace case?
Your Honor, I would submit that under these circumstances, he did not. He was a pro se party acting with limited knowledge of the proceedings, at least at the time he appeared in court. Furthermore, in this particular case, he specifically asked for in excess of $16,000 from the Justice Court. Now, parties absolutely can limit their request in order to avail themselves of the Justice Court's jurisdiction. I have done so. Many attorneys have done so. But it must be a conscious and knowing decision by the plaintiff. To do otherwise is limiting the plaintiff's rights to have their matter heard and essentially creating a procedural trap for the unwary.
Well, and the court could certainly have reserved his right to proceed in another form, and that, in fact, is your argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Okay. I anticipate that my esteemed friend is going to argue that the matter of the jurisdiction was not preserved. However, I would respectfully submit that Mr. Kangaroo did so, perhaps not with the eloquence that trained counsel might have, but adequately to place it before the district court and to place the defendants on notice. He discusses the fact that the justice court is a court of limited jurisdiction. He states that it was exceeding the jurisdiction. And even if hypothetically that were insufficient to reserve his rights, to preserve the argument, it can be reviewed for plain error. And I very respectfully submit that it was plain error. It was an error because it is giving preclusive effect to a judgment that, had it been rendered in an amount, would have exceeded the justice court's jurisdiction. It is plain because it is apparent by a review of the records on its face with minimal argument, and it affects his substantial right, his right to have the matter decided on the merits and to petition the judiciary, which are some of the most fundamental rights recognized in America. Your Honors, if there are no questions, I believe that covers everything.
You want to mention anything about claim preclusion?
It appears that one of the primary arguments in this case is that claim preclusion should apply, as the district court applied it, because it's not required that the claims be actually and necessarily litigated if they could have been brought in justice court. And it does appear that Mr. Kangaroo attempted to bring his claims for all of his damages in justice court. as it also appears, of course, according to him, that the Justice Court reserved his right to bring them in another forum. But doesn't claims preclusion really apply here? The exception of reservation of claims may apply, but doesn't claims preclusion apply?
Your Honor, under slightly different circumstances, I would agree that claim preclusion applies. They are identical parties, at least after it was stipulated that Ms. Pintar and her firm are properly removed. The underlying facts are the same. The claims are very similar. Under other circumstances, claim preclusion would apply. However, it is our contention that first, even though he attempted to bring the claims for claim preclusion to apply, the claims must be validly brought, and he could not do so while asking for $16,000. Moreover, as you alluded to, I respectfully assert that the prior judge reserving his rights is an exception that applies both to claim and issue preclusion. And it is an exception that not only should apply, to do otherwise risks substantial policy damage. To do otherwise means that it is an attack on the public's ability to trust the judiciary as they make statements, as they make statements from the bench. And that is a horrifying thought. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Wise.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. The basis of the appeal here are twofold. Number one is there that he relied on an alleged statement made in court that the Judge Brown directed me to seek any damages in a different forum, suggesting small claims court. I need to point out to the court that that first one needs to be totally void. That statement was made. There were two complaints here in Justice Court. The first one was an order regarding the personal property, return of the personal property. Mr. Kangaroo goes on record to say that this is where the judge ruled it moot because his property had been returned. Now, he did ask for damages, and you can ask for damages under the applicable statutes for this, which would be NRS 118A460 and NRS 40.239 section 9. And there is an award, a possible award of damages of $2,500. So if in fact Judge Brown said that, Hearing Master Brown said that, and counsel points out that I've never disputed it, it's an oral statement. And if there's not too much in the law that we can depend on, black and white. There's a lot of gray. Judges disagree with each other. Lawyers disagree with each other.
Ms. Pinter, let me just interrupt you, and I just want to clarify. The hearing master, I believe it was the hearing master in Justice Court, did make the oral statement to Mr. Kangaroo that he could pursue his other claims in another forum or another jurisdiction or some language to that effect. Is that correct?
I don't know. We don't have a record of it. I don't know.
Were you present?
I was present, but I don't recall that. I've been in many times in Hearing Master Brown's court, many times. And all the times I've heard him, he will direct them to the self-help center. And he'll say, I can't tell you what to do, but you might want to see the self-help center. And he might have recommended small claims. But that was for the one order regarding the return of his property, which small claims may be appropriate because you can get $2,500. I can't say, and we don't have any record of it. And to me, that's a glaring issue here, that a litigant can come forward and say, well, the judge told me this. We have no record of it. We have no transcript. And
counsel, didn't he allege it in his complaint? And aren't we supposed to accept all claims in a complaint as true at the motion to dismiss stage?
Well, you can accept them as true, but it should still be part of the record. It can't just be a party stating something.
Right, but it's a motion to dismiss that you filed, correct?
Correct. So I can't, but even if he did, counsel wants to suggest that we should have a public policy that a party can rely on a statement in court directing him. Now, counsel over here relies on the second statement of judgments, section 26, part B. Now, this is for claim splitting, specifically when a court has numerous claims, may have jurisdiction over some claims, but not others. And what it says is, and this is what counsel relies on, that the court in the first action has expressly reserved the plaintiff's right to maintain the second action. That's expressly, not, this may have been a suggestion. It may have been a comment the judge made. I can't say one way or another. I've heard hearing Master Brown say numerous times, you know, if you want to pursue something, you can go to the self-help center. Now, Mr. Kangaroo could have appealed this. That would have been the proper action. And much has been said here about being a pro se litigant. But if you look at some of Mr. Kangaroo's pleadings, including his opposition to the motion to dismiss, clearly he's had legal assistance because they're very sophisticated and clearly he's got legal help. It is unfair to have a different standard for a pro se litigant than someone that has engaged a lawyer. Now, they are paying for a lawyer, and it's unfair when the other part, and it happens, and I understand courts give a lot of latitude, and I understand that. They allow them, you know, to miss deadlines, to come to court without filing things. I understand that. But in this case, I don't think that's the proper standard for this court to consider to say he was a pro se litigant. We need to give him some leeway.
Well, Ms. Pinter, mm-hmm. let me ask this question. Okay. From your review of the record, such that it is, there's nothing to support that the Justice Court hearing master split the claims. We don't have any reference to splitting claims in the record. He clearly awarded rent and $550, but he didn't award any of the other damages. And some of the other damages are not contract or based on lost items or delay in getting personal property back. They're tort damages. And there is nothing in either judgment that would suggest that the hearing master actually ruled on the tort claims. And let's assume for a moment, and I appreciate your candor with us about your experiences in front of the hearing master, that he did suggest you got to bring these in another forum. Now, maybe that was small claims court. Maybe it was some other court that was unidentified. But clearly the hearing master did not put in a judgment, you know, zero tort damages or other types of damages were considered in the forms that we have, at least. But the fact that the hearing master told Mr. Kangaroo, perhaps you go to another forum, isn't that the type of reservation that is contemplated, that must be considered by the district court?
Okay, so, and I need to make this clear. There were two complaints.
No, I understand that.
This only applied, that statement only applied, and it's never been applied anywhere else, to the retrieval of personal property. And there was damages there of $2,500. There were no tort claims. There were no jurisdictional issues. It was, the court ruled it moot because his he had already recovered his belongings. Now, there was possible he did ask for damages, and the court under the statute can award $2,500. He could have appealed that. And because we don't have, and specifically, Justice Court Rules of Civil Procedure doesn't require a justice court to give facts specifically and state separately its conclusions of law. You can request them, and that's under Justice Court Rule 52. You can request them, and in fact, I've seen many times if you appeal it to district court, the district court will remand it back to justice court to get those findings of fact and conclusions of law. So we don't have them here.
I think, mm-hmm. I believe Judge Bulla was asking about the result of the other claims, not factual findings on those claims, but just what was the result of them, because there's no reference to any other claims.
Okay, so my understanding of the question by Justice Bulla was that was for the statement to go to a different forum. That statement only applied to the retrieval of personal property.
Were those addressed at different?
But you said you didn't remember any statements, so how can you?
No, I'm saying if he made that statement, by his allegations, right, it only applied by his allegations, and I don't remember it. By his allegations, this is what he says, that Judge Brown, after stating that the motion to retrieve essential property in case, and it names the case, 20E006443, is moot. He directed me to seek any damages in a different forum, suggesting small claims court, because Mr. Kangaroo had alleged that his belongings had been damaged or he didn't get them back. So those aren't tort claims.
Were those brought at the same time? So we have the motion to retrieve essential property. We also have his complaint that was separately filed. Were those heard at the same time?
No.
Were they heard by the same judge?
Yes.
Which one came first?
The retrieval of personal property.
But that was just deemed moot because he had his personal property back.
Correct.
I thought the second part of that on the expedited complaint dealt with the rental.
Yes, and that was a separate complaint.
Right.
Not
and
the same case.
But heard, you said it was heard at a different time. It was heard second.
Correct.
And in that particular document, that's where the $550 in rent was given.
Yes. And
but no other damages were given.
Correct. And so the question being, we don't know the basis of why he didn't award other damages. So number one, he could have asked for those under JCR 52, Justice Rules of Civil Procedure 52. Mr. Kangaroo could have asked for them. Or if he didn't, he could still have appealed, and then the district court could have asked for them. Rather, he got a judgment of $550. That's what the court found. He was asking for transportation, rent, medical, food that is now unusable. And then the pain and suffering is your tort claim that you were talking about. And that's the $10,000. Now, as far as jurisdiction, he only awarded him $550. So jurisdiction clearly was proper, because he would have never had the jurisdiction over the pain and suffering. But I don't see anywhere where the judge expressly split these claims and said, you have a tort claim here. I'm expressly allowing that. Since I don't have jurisdiction, Mr. Kangaroo could have asked for that. The proper remedy is to ask for it. He filed a motion for reconsideration. He clearly knew how to do that. And he could have asked for that, and then he could have appealed that or brought that in a different forum. The $10,000 still would have been justice court, but regular justice court, maybe not the eviction court.
So wouldn't the court's suggestion, though, to bring your damages in a different forum, it doesn't necessarily matter at which hearing that was said, but at one of the hearings, the mm-hmm. hearing master says that. So Mr. Kangaroo accepts that direction and then brings the action in district court. At a minimum, aren't there genuine disputes of fact of what happened that perhaps the district court should sort out on remand?
So, and my answer to that is, when he brought the district court case, those were the claims that he had brought for the expedited relief, the complaint for expedited relief. I showed in my brief that they were identical. So let's look back at claim preclusion. Now, there are three parts to it. Number one, the parties were fully heard, well, they're the same parties. The parties were fully heard, and there was a hearing. Hearing doesn't have to be long. It doesn't have to be a trial. I was at the hearing, and hearing Master Brown is very thorough in Mr. Kangaroo had exhibits. He had produced evidence to support his claim. The court supported its decision with a reasoned opinion. Now here that's absent, but Justice Court Rule 52 allows a court not to have those conclusions of law, those statements of fact and conclusions of law. However, a litigant can request them, or you can still appeal without them. And I've seen many times where the district court then remands it back to the justice court and saying, why did you come to that decision? That was his remedy. That was his proper remedy. And finally, that it was subject to appeal. There was a judgment of $550. That judgment was paid off. There was a judgment. Out of all of those claims, the hearing master Brown found in favor of him for $550. He accept that as a judgment.
So, Ms. Pintor, mm-hmm. let's assume that claims preclusion does apply here based mm-hmm. on your analysis. Mm-hmm. But isn't the reservation an exception to claims preclusion?
If it meets the standard.
And what standard should we apply? Because I believe it was pointed out that we don't really have one yet in Nevada, do we?
Well, there's not one anywhere. I looked throughout the United States. And first of all, there has to be something of, now, if we had got a decision, a reasoned decision, if the Justice Court, if someone had requested it, we're guessing right now. We don't know. And I don't think it's proper to guess when we're dealing with an appeal. Here's what the second statement of judgment, which counsel has relied on, has expressly reserved. He said, maybe you have small claims. Well, small claims, you can't even bring tort claims. So clearly that didn't apply. That was his statement, that maybe you have a different form for damages in small claims. It applied to the property, not to the expedited relief. So if you want to adopt this, which is fine, the court in the first action has expressly reserved. I don't think a statement that I don't remember that is being relied on here is the proper standard. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Your Honors, much was made about arguments that to the extent the Justice Court judge may have reserved Mr. Kangaloo's rights, it was related only to the property. I do not believe there is anything in the record to support that. While the hearings were on separate matters, they were related, they were consolidated, they were on the same day. And in terms of Mr. Kangaloo's statements, nothing I'm aware of that he said would support a finding that his rights were only reserved as to the property. In fact, that would make little sense when it was dismissed as moot. The other thing that was argued extensively is that it would be unfair to treat a pro se litigant differently. But we are not asking for different treatment for a pro se litigant. I submit that this would apply the same to licensed counsel or any pro se litigant. If a judge reserves your right to bring another action, it is reserved. Now, I do acknowledge that particularly when it comes to the question of whether something was preserved for appeal, that licensed counsel likely would have fleshed out the argument substantially more in the court below, but I would respectfully submit that he did enough. And even if he did not, I'd respectfully submit that even under a clear error standard, which in this court's discretion, it may review for even unpreserved arguments, the judgment should be set aside. And the matter should be allowed to proceed on the merits.
Is the clear error the district court's failure to consider what occurred in justice court before reaching its decision on claim preclusion?
Your Honor, I would submit that that is clear error. However, I would submit that when it comes to the jurisdictional question, that is much more plain error. It is an error that is plain on the face, relying only on his complaint before the Justice Court, which asked for $16,000, and it affects his substantive rights to have his matter heard on the merits. There was also a great deal of discussion as to whether this could have been appealed. Theoretically, it could have been. And had the Justice Court judge, had Hearing Master Brown not instructed him that he could bring the matter in another forum, that would have been his correct and only remedy. Assuming the Justice Court had jurisdiction in the first place, which I respectfully submit it does not. But Hearing Master Brown did make that statement, or at a bare minimum, allegedly made the statement and it was uncontroverted. And it is contrary to policy, in addition to contrary to Restatement of Judgment Section 26, to permit a statement, or excuse me, to make it so that a litigant cannot rely on a statement made by a judge or hearing master from the bench. That results in a distrust of the judiciary, and the judiciary relies on the public's trust. That should not be impinged. Now, there is discussion about the fact that Restatement Section 26 deals with claim splitting. In a literal sense, that is true. However, claim splitting underlies claim preclusion and is related to issue preclusion as well. And in Boca Park, a different subsection of Restatement of Judgment Section 26 was expressly adopted in dealing with the question of claim preclusion. Now, that was a different section in Boca Park. They were looking at the distinction between asking purely for declaratory relief and whether you can bring a subsequent action for damages. However, the underlying principles are very similar. It is a minuscule step to adopt the other subsection of a section that's already been endorsed by the Nevada Supreme Court, particularly when I would submit that this subsection carries greater policy weight to cast questions on the ability of the public to trust the judiciary, weakens the judiciary, weakens the entire legal system, and it causes confusion amongst the public. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weissman. Thank you, Mr. Tart.